This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most, sending a lot of good vibrations and love out to the worldwide audience. And today we have a show that is in relationship to the whole planet. As we all know, it's the most crucial topic, our ecosphere, our living conditions in this beautiful place we live. Our guest today has spent an entire lifetime dedicated to preservation, ecology, environmental issues, conservation. He's also a livestock farmer. He is the president and co-founder of the Savory Institute. It's such an honor to finally welcome to the show Mr. Alan Savory. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Paul, for inviting me. It is, as you say, the most important subject in the world, I believe.
I agree. Before we venture in that direction, I wonder, just on a personal level, how has the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, affected you and your loved ones over the last year?
Well, you know, I was fortunate to get locked down in Zimbabwe for 8 months. So it was a lovely place to be in my very primitive bush camp home with all the wildlife and the poor people I liked being amongst. And so it was good. We were out of it. They took sensible precautions right away. And now I'm back in Stuart. So it hasn't impacted us personally. Of course, it has, like everybody, with having to be in virtual meetings. But perhaps in the long term, the best thing that'll come out of it, and I always try to look for the best, is that a simple virus, by bringing the global economy virtually to its knees in a couple of months, did more than the 4 years or so of World War II that I grew up in, and hopefully will make us realize we are one species, team humanity, and we're going to rise or fall together, and that our economies, our environment, our health are one. You cannot separate them.
What a beautiful perspective, and I agree. And don't you see a connection in the virus and its relationship to the globe and that of climate change? Not only does a hotter planet produce more viruses and bacteria, but also in the same way that climate change could do the same thing to us. I feel like Corona was almost a more gentle message and warning earlier that I hopefully will heed so we don't have to experience what's to come, which could be much worse.
Yeah, Paul, you know, what you're saying is absolutely right. But if I could, you know, we long ago, 35 years ago, when I was commissioned to train thousands of people, professors, economists, etc., by USDA in the holistic management framework we were developing, I used to use it to analyze policies. We analyzed hundreds of policies with economists, with biologists, agriculture, wildlife, everything. And they concluded, and I published that for 35 years ago, that they could now recognize that unsound resource management was universal in the United States. And then one of the things I used to have them analyze was climate change. And I actually stopped doing it and refused to ever do it again roughly 35 years ago. And the reason I stopped doing it was I saw the response. What we analyzed indicated to us, without any of the fancy models or anything, indicated to us that this wasn't the beginning of our problems, it was the beginning of the end, and that it was mind-bogglingly serious. And I noticed the reaction of all those professional people working on it wasn't one of let's get stuck in and do something. The reaction was, oh my God, if it's that serious, we might as well just carry on the party. And literally refused to ever do it again, and I have held to that. So it is a very desperate situation. But I'm a little bit heartened at the moment, because although we've gone through decades of denial that we were causing climate change. As you know, within the last year or so, we have finally had the majority of scientists acknowledge that humans are causing climate change. Now, that acknowledgement is enormous, because if you just use common sense, you can only interpret that in one way, and that is, if we are causing it and not God or something out there in space causing it, then there's only one possibility, and that is we're doing it through our management of nature, our management of everything. So now we can come down, hopefully, to stop blaming fossil fuels and livestock, as we've done in the case of livestock for nearly 10,000 years, in the case of fossil fuels, mostly during my lifetime. Those are resources. And if we can come down to focusing, if there's a single cause and its management, now if we can focus on that, we have a hope for future generations. But if we do not focus on the cause and we continue to blame fossil fuels and livestock and corporate corruption and all the things that people blame, there is no hope for the youth of for the future other than a future of extreme violence.
I agree. And we really don't have time for blame and shame or climate doom, as the scientist Michael Mann says. We have the awareness and the science to see what's going on. Thank God it's caused by us, because that means at least we can uncause it. If, like you say, it was an outer phenomenon, we would be victims and at the mercy of this phenomenon. So, what stands between us? We have all this means, and yet we're not moving fast enough, but thank God we are increasing our movement. What's the great obstacle? Is it just the human resistance to change in general?
No, it's not the human resistance to change in general. It's, let me put it this way. Let's take it, management is the problem. Now, the first thing I want to do is just clear my position in this. I am not particularly wise. I don't have a very bright brain. I'm in awe of physicists and mathematicians and many, many people and what they do. The only reason I'm talking to you today is almost by accident and circumstances. When I was a 20-year-old young scientist, I was put into an extremely responsible position, not held before by anybody under 40, 45. And I was working with some of the world's top ecologists, Sir Frank Fraser Darling, two professors in America, etc. But the buck stopped with me. I was the scientist who had to actually make the policies recommendations in a large area. And I became very aware that we professional scientists did not know what to do, because the buck stopped with me. So I could take all the advice and help from these people who were my mentors and became lifelong friends, but I had to actually make the decisions, and I realized we had no idea what to do. And I was looking at appalling environmental degradation in the wildest parts of Africa that we were setting aside as future national parks. Now, poachers weren't the problem. Nothing was the problem. We were the problem. We didn't know how to manage that complexity. And so at that point in my life, in my early 20s, I switched from being a researcher, an ecologist studying plants and soil and elephants and animals, to studying, really, why is it we professional people don't know what to do? We say we know what to do. We give advice. But actually, when we're in charge, it's no better. And so I began studying what now the world scientists have come to realize, that management is the problem. So I do stress, I don't have any wisdom. It's just unique set of circumstances set me to studying professionals' role in management over 60 years ago, where scientists are only acknowledging it now and then continuing to blame resources. So having said that, let's go on from there. You say we've got all the awareness in the science, and is it the normal hang-up about, change? Not really, but look at it this way. If management is the problem, all right, then what do we manage? If you look at it in the world, we produce food and fiber, meat, corn, everything you can name, all the food we feed our cities with from nature. We produce electricity from nature, fossil fuels, geothermal, wind, solar, whatever. We produce and make wonderful music, orchestras, cathedrals, cities, bombs, transport, trains, planes, computers, everything from a toothbrush to space exploration vehicles. So there are millions of things we produce or make. We don't manage them. And all of those things we produce or make have something in common. If we stop producing them, they stop. If a battery goes dead, they stop. If we run out of fuel, they stop. They're not self-organizing. They cannot continue on their own. Now, if we say, all right, system science, we've long ago known that everything we make or produce is complicated. It's not complex because it's not self-organizing. Everything we make or produce does what we intend it to do. Food feeds us. Electricity lights our homes. A car drives, etc. Toothbrush cleans your teeth. So they do what they're designed to do. They don't do unexpected things. They'll have unexpected results on the environment, but they don't do more than we intend them to do. They don't have emergent properties, as they call it. All right, so take those out of the way. Then what is it that we manage that is causing climate change? Well, we manage ourselves. We all manage our lives, our communities, and then beyond our communities and very small businesses, we have to manage through institutions. We form organizations because it's our only way to manage at large scale. So we manage humans and institutions. We manage nature to produce our energy, our food, and every single thing that sustains civilization. Okay, so that's from managing nature. And what else do we manage? We manage economies and global finance. We manage. You don't make those. All of those three things we manage. Now, when we look at the three things, and there are only three things that humans manage, when we look at them, we see they also have features in common. All of them continue. If a person dies, if thousands of species die, if an entire economy collapses, if the entire board of a big organization dies in a car crash or whatever, the organization carries on. When people die, the family carries on, the community carries on. Even as I've experienced, when an entire economy collapses totally, the country just carried on a barter economy, a black market economy, that was actually more honest and more integrity in it than the mainstream economy. Nothing stopped. So these things we manage, we find they're all self-organizing. They don't stop if we run out of fuel or a part breaks or anything like that. And they all have emergent properties. You cannot predict their properties from what you conceive of as the parts in them. So you can know everything in the world about oxygen and everything in the world about hydrogen. And if I said to you, well, what about water? You'd say, what the hell is that? You wouldn't even know that if you bring hydrogen and oxygen together, you have something totally different. It's water with totally different properties. I'm just giving a simple example. So the three things we manage is where the problem lies. Now, in that, if you think about what I've just said, Paul, and let's just use common sense. I said we're managing nature and economies, but we cannot manage nature or economies at scale except through institutions. In other words, government and world leaders' policies, political parties' policies. That is how we manage at scale economies and nature. So when we look at the institutions, which is where we manage, as I say, at scale, they themselves are complex with emergent properties, okay, and doing unexpected things. So where you and I and every single person listening to us can use common sense, and every human can use common sense, for an institution to use common sense is very close to impossible.
I laughed out loud at that. I know, because it's so true. It's such a dichotomy, but it's so true.
Correct. Now, where you and I, as individuals, and every individual is capable of saying, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I screwed up. Like I did in my TED talk, I said I made the biggest mistake of my life that led to government policy killing 40,000 elephants. I'm sorry, but it changed me and it led me to solutions. Now, I can say that, but to this day, no institution that did that has ever admitted to error, and they will never. So when institutions do something wrong, it's extremely rare for them to admit error. What they do is to circle the wagons and protect the institution. And you've only got to look at the Catholic Church to see that. An enormous church, millions of wonderful people, okay? And yet for how many centuries have they protected pedophile priests? They've never said, no, the church was wrong or the priests were wrong. They've protected them, protected the church, and gone against their very mission to protect the innocent children. So, and it's not because anybody's bad. It's how institutions behave. There are complex organizations. And so coming now back to your question of why can't we change and look at the three things we manage? I didn't understand all this. It took me 50 years to understand it, because in 1984, the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, by then, they knew that every policy in the United States managing resources was unsound. But the institutional response to us discovering that, with over 2,000 scientists and economists, the institutional response was to ban further training. So now we've got to say, well, how do we get new knowledge into our institutions if through them we have to save humanity and manage nature, energy, agriculture that are destroying civilization as we know it? And that's what I'm battling with right now, is how do we find a way when nobody is being bad? Literally, I don't blame anybody. I don't blame corporate greed or any of these things, because I now know they're not the problem. The problem is how institutions develop policies. And when I said in 1984 we had discovered what was wrong in those, in the way we did it, there are only two simple things. There are two very simple things that we do wrong in our institutions. Literally, if I'm talking, well, my daughter's doing a lot of it now. She's teaching 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 7-year-old children, and they get it immediately and understand it immediately. But people with PhDs are incapable of understanding. Now, that's not because one group is intelligent, the other isn't. It's because it's a paradigm problem. And so there are two very simple things that institutions do wrong. A child can understand that easily. Adults find it very difficult. And it's almost impossible to get them accepted by any institution under about 200 years, if we look at history. nothing has changed since Galileo and Copernicus. If you discover something new, all right, it usually leads to some controversy, some difficulty with changing, but within a decade or so, it'll be changed. People will first condemn it, then they'll discuss it and say maybe, and then they'll deny that they ever were against it, and Nobel Prizes will be given, and so on. That happens with all new discoveries, that process of resistance and change and so on. Now, if you get a particular type of discovery that goes totally against all human beliefs, then you don't see that same process. You just see individuals able to grasp it, small groups of people able to grasp it, institutions will fight it, resist it, and oppose it for 100, 200 or more years until the whole of society has changed its view, then institutions change. So that's what we're up against, because if we're going to have to save civilization, address global desertification, mega fires, climate change, all the symptoms of this, the mass emigration to Europe, the United States changing the political face of Europe, the increasingly violent wars, recruitment to dissident organizations, the increasing droughts and floods, and all of these things that are symptoms of it. If we're going to address that, it has to be through institutions. And the problem, as I say, is how can we get political leaders to understand the two simple ideas and things that we're doing wrong? And then it'll begin to change everything.
Wow. And that is such a core paradigm shift across many fields for what you just stated so eloquently. And when you talked about institutions, and especially the Vatican, and I thought of countries and things, they, once they become a certain size, they become preoccupied with their own power and their own existence. It doesn't matter what else. They have to, that's all they care about. And they forget their original missions usually. They just want to keep going and concentrate power. And what I hear in the subtlety of what you said too is that it's going to have to be a sort of decentralized, holistic, million points of light, 100 monkey theory type of approach from all walks and all corners to create the critical mass to then drag the institutions and the political establishments along, because they always seem to be the last on the boat, by and large. Did I read all that correctly, or did I miss some points?
No, you said it correctly. That is what happens and has happened throughout history. So, for example, when we didn't know anything about how something invisible could cause disease, and a Hungarian doctor, in effect, discovered bacteria, all right, Semmelweis, and he discovered that if he just washed his hands after cutting up corpses before he went to the maternity wards, he would save hundreds of women's lives. Now, it was a pretty big discovery, all right? Now, how long did it take that to be accepted, and what happened to him? If you look at it, he was so persecuted by the authorities of the day, proof by authority, not science or anything else, that he died in a mental asylum. And I've had the same treatment, and I used to resent it. No, now I don't. I understand it's just natural. And so I just jokingly say, thank God I was insane 50 years ago. It saved me. Because nobody's being bad. It is how institutions behave when truly new knowledge comes in. Now, we could change incrementally, slowly, like you're describing, and all the evidence shows that that will take a minimum of 100 to 200 years. It took the Royal Navy 200 years to accept that lime juice would stop scurvy. Over 1 million sailors died. It was vital to Britain's future. But when they finally did, it took a further 70 years, I believe, before the Merchant Navy did so. So yes, institutions take on a life of their own, but we have to have them, we have to manage through them. Now, I don't like doomsday stuff. So I know, I look at the history, I look at the science, I look at the social science, the research, and I see, okay, when a new, totally new concept going against centuries, thousands of years of human belief comes up, it will take 200 or 300 years to permeate society to the point that institutions change. Now, I know, and you know, and everybody listening to us knows, we don't have that much time. If we've got to manage through institutions, we have to begin to look at the wicked problems of institutions. So what I've been doing for the last year or so with the Savory Institute and Daniela Howell, our CEO and our staff, is while they've got on with the main strategy that we're working on, I've been on the side saying, just putting hundreds of hours into thought and deep discussion with a few people as to how can we find a way around this to help world leaders respond quickly. Like Greta Thunberg and millions of youth are demanding political action, but what action? If the politicians continue to develop policy, as all politicians do, it is causing climate change. So demanding action is only going to speed climate change. Now, how do you get that around that? And I've come up with two or three ways. And if you like, I can go into them. The two simple beliefs, let me cover them first. The first is that all humans believe that there are hundreds of ways of making decisions and managing. There are universities, there are libraries full of it, everything. That's a human belief. I held it myself. I was taught it at university. What we discovered in 1983, approximately, was that belief is wrong. There's only one way that humans make decisions. All humans, including at government level, make decisions the same way. And it's a reductionist way, which is incapable of dealing with complexity of society, nature, and economies. That's why we're running into trouble. So that belief was faulty. Now, the new or slightly modified way of making decisions is actually far easier. It gets everybody behind you. It resolves conflict, etc. But we have to get politicians to know about it. Now, the second belief is that all scientists, and this included me earlier, believe we could manage nature, economies, everything we're doing with tools, because we can, that's the only way we can. You cannot do anything with your creativity. You cannot do anything with your labor, your hands. You cannot do anything with money until you pick up a tool. If I say to you or any person listening to us now, Paul, I'd like you to go and drink water or milk, how would you do so? And you would quickly realize that if I forbid you from using technology, a tool of technology, you would have to go to the nearest river and drink with your hands and mouth, or you'd have to go to the nearest cow and suck. We cannot even drink milk or water without a tool. And so it is through life. Now, our belief and the training in every university in the world is that scientists have got thousands of tools. Now, we broke that one in the 1980s when the US government commissioned me to put 2,000 scientists and others, land management agency people, university graduates and so on, and professors through training. One of the things I got them to do to break that one was I said, I want all of you to list every tool you've ever been trained to use. No matter what your profession, I don't care what your profession is, I don't care what university in the world you trained in, I want you to list every tool you were trained to use. And while you're doing it, also list any tool you've ever used in your private life. And people would sit for an hour, half an hour, just drawing up lists of tools. Then we would break it into categories, and it became two tools, technology and fire. And the human belief, including Nobel laureates, is that we're going to solve global desertification, mega fires, climate change, and all these symptoms using only technology and fire. It's impossible. Common sense tells you it's impossible. It's a biological problem. So you see how simple the ideas are. We have no option, as I said in the TED talk, and I was severely criticized by academics for it. I said, we have no option but to start using livestock, animals, as a tool. Not to eat. I don't care whether you eat them or not. We would eat them, probably, but you have no option but to start using animals as a tool. So these two ideas are very, very simple.
And you had that beautiful breakthrough with the soil and the way you did it. And to me, the proof was in, you could look at an arid desert type landscape, and then it all made sense. And I've studied soil to a degree, nothing like you or say Zach Bush or some of these other people, but you come back in a few years and it's grass taller than you and green and water ponds. I mean, to me, nature proved your hypothesis through real life trial. It wasn't a theoretical experiment.
Yeah, I have no theory. And by the way, thanks for crediting me with studying soil. I've done hardly any studies on soil. I'm not a researcher. As I said, I switched to researching, if you like, or studying our role as professional people in management of complexity. I know very little about soil. Almost everything I know about soil, I read in textbooks that were written before I was born. The knowledge was there, it just wasn't being used properly. And let me cover that point. Let me take one of the ways we could break through. And I've made this suggestion, but it fell on stony ground and nobody took me up. I've said, you know, what we could do is take one issue that is pretty neutral and get global attention on it. The media, investigative reporters, everybody. And that is the management of national parks. If we just took one issue like that and got the world to just sit steady and let us the policy of governments, etc. Take national parks. The policies managing national parks in every country in the world are based on, as all policies are, of governments or World Wildlife Fund or any of these people, are based on expert advice. Now, if you look at the national parks of, say, my country, Zimbabwe, or you could take the United States, we've got in the policy managing our national parks, we've got all the expertise in the world from every university. Nobody denies the government knowledge. We've got enormous sums of money can be made available from government or internationally. We have the gigantic organizations like World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, Africa Parks, International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the government itself and its departments of wildlife. We've got, as I say, the universities of the world. So we have no shortage of expert advice. I think I can say we have all the expert advice available in the world to develop policy. And that policy is approved by World Wildlife Fund and IUCN and all the big environmental agencies in the world. Now, when we look at that policy in the management of the national parks around my home, and we've got 30 national parks, they are our worst examples of habitat destruction, biodiversity loss, contribution to desertification and climate change. Now, how can it be that with the way governments develop policies and institutions develop policies, we have all of this incredible amount of scientific advice, and the end result is that national parks, where you cannot blame corruption, greed, corporations, coal, oil, livestock, there's nothing left to blame. And they are appalling examples of biodiversity loss, etc. That, if we could just get, and no, there are no published papers, there are no peer-reviewed papers on what I'm talking about, because institutions will never admit to failure. So if we could get the world to just focus on that, and some global leader, I had hoped somebody like Prince Charles or somebody like that, to just say, let's convene a meeting, a thing, and let's take national parks and just let's use the holistic framework to see if a policy could be developed that is different. And I promise you, if we did that, within a week or so, everybody would see, oh my goodness, there's no need for this. All the knowledge is available. What is wrong is the way in which governments develop policies. That's where the problem lies.
Can I bring this down to the basic level of, say, it was me and my household? I make tons of money, and yet I'm always broke. We have a beautiful house, but it's a mess. We buy lots of food, but lots of it goes bad, and we end up throwing tons of it out. We had some dogs and cats, but because somehow we mismanaged how we held them, some of them died for no reason, but they just died. We're having a lot of dogs die off, and on and on and on. We had a beautiful car, but because we didn't change the oil on a regular basis, the engine blew up. Is that what I'm hearing? It's all here and it would work. It's just we're not managing it correctly.
Correct. Yeah, you're me. I do these some of these things as well. We all do. So let's take it, as you say. What about you and the household? You in anybody in the household develops policies in the same way government does, essentially. They develop them because there's a problem. So let's say we in a household want a policy for our children about watching television. We want them to do their schoolwork, their homework. So we lay down a policy because we've got a problem. They're spending too much time on the cell phone or watching whatever. So we dictate that policy. And what do the kids do? They do everything they can to work their way around it. Okay, because we develop policies to address a problem. And that's what all governments do. That's the problem starting right there. When you're dealing with something complex, as you are with nature, institutions, economies, you cannot reduce anything to the problem without it being called reductionist. You cannot reduce that inescapable. You can't manage institutions, economy, or nature separate from one another. They're like the hydrogen and the oxygen and the water. They are one. Now, you can't reduce your policies to a problem. Now, if you want a very simple example, I had one years ago. We were training an African woman who came and stayed with my wife and I for 6 months while we were training her to go back to her community in Africa and begin working with them. And I was teaching her about how you have to have a holistic context, which is both the reason or the context for your actions. And you have to do this in a community or anything else. And she said, could I do this in my own life? And I said, yes, of course you can. And she said, will you help me? And I said, yeah. So we sat down with her and I said, now what are you managing? You're managing your life, your single mother. You've got a young son that you're educating. Who makes decisions for you? Only you. Nobody has veto power over your decisions. Okay, so it's you managing your life. Now, instead of doing what every human does and making every single decision to meet your needs, your desires, or to address a problem, which is what every human does, instead of doing that, why don't you decide how you want your life to be? And we'll tie it to your life-supporting environment and your behavior and give you that as a context for your decisions. So I sat and helped her do that. It took half an hour. And she determined how she wanted her life to be, raising her children, what her behavior had to be for people to be supporting her always, and a very generic connection to the land, because everything that they ate or consumed came from the land, and everything goes back to the land. So very generic description of clean air, clean water, nutritious food, etc. So I said, now that you've got that as a context for your life, just try that. Begin making your decisions in that context. And about a week or so later, she came to me very excited. She said, damn it, this works. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, I took my son and we went to the supermarket. I got one of the trolleys and went around the shelves. I had my shopping list and my son and I put all the things we needed in the trolley. And I went to the checkout counter and there were six people ahead of me, so I had to wait. And she said, while I was waiting, I looked at my shopping list and I remembered what you'd said and I remembered my holistic context for my life. And I looked at my shopping list and every item on it and I saw, oh my goodness, need. I need this. I desire this. My son desires this. I need this. And she said, I thought of those relative to my life and educating my son, etc. And she said, sheepishly, I went and put half the things back on the shelf. That's it. It's that simple. That's why an eight-year-old child can grasp it, but a person with a PhD can't.
Wow. I love what you did there. And it's true, psychologically, instead of making rules for things we're against, which, like you say, people work around and never work, you have to figure out what you really want to create and then move towards that rather than trying to move away from the unpleasant outcome. It's almost like whatever you're focusing on or trying to avoid, you will create. But if you say, let's turn this into a lush landscape, let's manage our blank better, then instead of making rules against, by having a stated goal, like let's create and build this, for whatever reason, psychologically, the brain and who we are, it functions more effectively and efficiently that way. And that it works. It's the truth.
Yeah, Paul, you're getting there. It's you're almost there. But you even your goal, you say you mentioned having a goal. Your goal needs to be in context. So once you have a holistic context, even your goals, you make sure they're in line with it. Because at the moment, people have goals.
Oh, I see what you did. Yes. You can't be fragmented. How could you be in good health and yet then go do this? Your job has to align with your health. Your health has to align with who you hang out with and what you eat, what you watch.
Health has to align to the economy, the health, and the environment all have to align. Yeah.
And when everything's integrated, that's what the word integrity comes from. It's integrated. There's integrity in the system personally and then within the outer, which is the larger system and communities. So if you have that core stated, this is what we are, then whatever isn't in alignment with that should be discarded like her shopping list. And then it's easy to embrace. You don't have to be making difficult value decisions. If you're all about people first, you wouldn't put kids in cages. It's a non-starter. Is that too mind-based?
Well, let's use this as a sort of teaching example. You know, I've been forced into a position of training thousands of people over the year, from professors to illiterate people. And I've never, ever found ignorance block learning. Never come across it. Only two things block us learning. One is what we already know, and the other is our egos. Those are the only two things I've ever found blocking learning. That's why children learn this so quickly, because they don't know a lot already, and their egos are not staked. They haven't pinned their self-esteem to their position or their work or their reputation or anything else. And so as I'm talking to you, do you see what you're doing is you're trying to relate it to what you know. That's what we all do. So it's actually easier when talking about holistic management, the management that we need to address the complexity, it's actually much easier to just do it than it is to talk about it. If you talk about it, it gets more and more confusing. So let me use an analogy. If you had never seen a bicycle and nobody listening to us had ever known about a bicycle. And I had a bicycle, and I'd learnt how to ride it, and now I was explaining to you how to ride a bicycle. The more I explained, the more confusing it would get. Now, if you and I could just be together, or anybody, with the bicycle, probably within an hour you'd be riding it. And that's what we find with holistic management. When I sit with a group of people, no matter how divisive, no matter how much they're in conflict, if I sit and can just get them to keep quiet for a few moments and begin to manage holistically, it's incredible to see the harmony that develops.
I see what you're saying. It's instinctual and intuitive. That's why you say the 8-year-old can figure it out and do it without effort, and the PhD with all the training gets in the way. Is that getting away from our primal instincts and intuition and our connection to all things?
Well, I'm guilty of that. I'm talking to you now, and I can make it very simple, and I sent you some things. I can make it very simple. It's not because I'm clever or wise or anything. It took me 65 years because I'm a human. I was blocking myself with what I knew. Now I feel stupid when I look back on it.
Sounds like my whole life at times. Do you meditate? Do you get quiet and you're just tuning into like a flow? I hate the words like metaphysical and spiritual because they quantify a transcendent element of our existence.
No, I don't do any of that. But what I do is I do like to just go fishing, just be quiet, just be in the bush. And I do a tremendous lot of thinking. For every word I speak, I probably spend hours thinking. I like to get away from people and just think. And when I hear people all talking, and I see the confusion, I like to just pull aside and start thinking, why is this so confusing? Why are people in conflict? What is the cause of this? Because most people are good. Most people mean well. And yet we get these unintended consequences.
And you're asking questions rather than feeling you know. And a question is an opening, where a statement is a closed context.
And also, I have only one desire, and that's for team humanity to be better, to succeed. I don't have a desire for a legacy or recognition or anything else. That's why I personally have no problem at all saying I was wrong. But I find a lot of other people find that difficult, particularly professional people. And almost everything that I do was learnt by doing things that were wrong, but being willing to say so quickly. As soon as you see it's wrong, just what's wrong with saying that's wrong?
Why do you care so much? Why didn't at some point you just said, oh, these idiot heathen ignoramuses, oh, the hell with you. I'm just going to go walk the brush out in Africa and leave you to your own.
No, I didn't say that.
No, I'm saying, why didn't you?
I have often been asked that question because I, have been through a tremendous lot of abuse. You can Google me and you can see what a charlatan I am. And it's all proof by authority because authorities say so. It's not so having gone through many years, I've been asked that question often. So I've given it deep thought as to why, really, what is the real deep motive, etc. And I put it to one word, caring. If you care enough about the future of all life, I love wildlife, I love people, but if you care enough about all that, you'll do whatever you have to do to save it. And I've often mentioned what was a turning point in my life was we were in the middle of civil war. I was in the army. I was also trying to do my scientific work, my wildlife work, etc. And I was sitting on the banks of a river in Zimbabwe when it came down in flood, muddy water flowing by, a couple of dead donkeys, trees floating by. And I just began crying. And in those days, you know, adults, men didn't admit to crying. And I literally just sobbed my heart out. I was on my own. And I thought, and why am I in the army? Why am I fighting a war for politicians I don't believe in, for policies I don't believe in? Why am I doing all this? And here's this river flowing by with mud and soil going out. This is destroying my whole nation. This is destroying the world. So aren't I prepared to put all my effort into solving that, even if it means giving my life? And at that moment, I said, yes, I'm going to do that.
Wow, that's powerful. When you're out there amongst the animals, the brush in the wild, do you feel almost sometimes like nature, the earth, informs you and speaks through the wind to you? And there's like a knowing. I know there's the biophilia effect scientifically. That's too much thinking. But I never feel better than when I'm out on a deserted beach in the ocean or in a forest on a mountain with nothing but the sound of nature and my being out there. And I always feel like a special guest. But if my ego and mind can drop away, the veil gets really thin and I feel like I'm part of it, like the way the wind blows through reeds. And I know I'm saying a lot of words, but out there, and do you feel that way? I always feel it informing too, like trying to love and help, like it cares.
You know, Paul, if I said, you know, I believed all that, or I felt all that stuff, I'd be bullshitting you. I don't. I'm not poetic. I'm just a very practical, simple person. I just want simple answers, solutions to problems, and I don't do much of any of that. I really don't. I am probably, you'd say, very spiritual. I'm just in awe of the wonders of nature and how evolution has worked and how many millions of years it's taken to develop us, our minds. You know, I read other people's theories like Smuts and so on, but I don't get wax poetic and say that nature speaks to me or any of that stuff, I'm afraid. And if one, funny enough, talking of poetry, in the darkest days when I was really being hammered on all sides and I was leading the political opposition and trying to stop racism and end a civil war and trying to solve these problems, there's one thing I would carry with me all the time that helped keep me sane. And I don't know if you know it, it was Kipling's poem, If.
That's a masterpiece, that poem.
Correct. I must have read that poem thousands of times. There's so much wisdom in that.
I will christen you a very pragmatic spiritualist. You're a great dichotomy there. And you know what's great? You do it with your actions and the way you move and through the world. Alan, what would you tell? We have so many listeners all over the world, India, these different countries, Japan, Korea, South Korea. Every one, a cell in the body of humanity. I know you don't want to tell or give advice or whatever, but they listen, they tune in. Any words to them, since it's a unique opportunity to just sit you and them, and what they might do to become more aligned with what we're talking about in their own unique way, not in Alan's way or Paul's way?
Well, that will always be in their unique way. That's the beauty of holistic management, is that everybody, every nation, every culture develops its own holistic context. But we are one species, humans, despite people looking as different as a pygmy in the Congo or an Eskimo or a North American European. I mean, you know, you could look at humans all around the world and you could almost say we're different species, but we're not. We are just one team humanity and we're all in this boat together. And if I would just urge everybody to try to stop arguing and fighting and everything and begin looking at the possibility of solving your problems by just addressing the cause, which is management. And they can just go to the Savory Institute, and we'll connect them with any number of others. We've got about 50 hubs around the world now, where local people in their own culture, their own language, are just pulling together and beginning to manage holistically. We even have the first university-led hub. All of that information and connecting them is available just through the Savory Institute. And I just urge them to just start inquiring, care enough to start looking for solutions and stop the blaming.
Beautiful. And I want to thank you too, because you're busy and you took some time out for me and these people and for all the work you are doing. I know you're not in it for praise, but I would be remiss if I didn't express my own personal gratitude for what you've done and are doing and where you're trying to take us. Thank you. And I would love to continue the conversation down the road, hopefully as we progress and we continue to discover for ourselves and collectively the path towards greater alignment and collective cooperation.
Well, Paul, if I might just have a last comment, I appreciate your thanks, but I think I owe a greater thanks to you, because the leaders in society are the people who get information to society, the people like yourself. They are not the people who discover new ideas. The leaders of society are people like yourself, the bloggers, the documentary film producers, the writers, the people who get the knowledge to society despite institutions.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.